Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 11th of January, and it's all things political. The Iowa caucuses are pretty soon now, just a few weeks away, and we're going to be talking about, now we can talk about numbers here because we're getting close to the actual contest. These polls are from yesterday, the results. NBC Wall Street Journal Marist survey showing among likely Democratic caucus goers, Hillary Clinton now edges Bernie Sanders by just 3 points, 48% to 45%. His numbers have been going up in Iowa. We'll be talking about those numbers. And in New Hampshire, Sanders trumps Clinton by 4 points. On the Republican side of the race, same poll released yesterday shows that Ted Cruz takes 28% in Iowa, edging Donald Trump, who sits at 24%. Both of these polls are within the 4.8 percentage point margin of error. So we'll be looking at those in just a moment with our guest, who, by the way, is Craig Gilbert. Craig's written an interesting piece on the politics of guns in Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race. Johnson and Feingold both have vulnerabilities in how the public perceives their approach to terrorism. Some see Johnson as too hawkish. Others say Feingold is too dovish. The president, of course, has made guns an issue in this campaign. And Craig's article says the issue could animate this year's U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin. He also wrote an interesting piece a little while ago about why Donald Trump doesn't seem to be performing very well in the state of Wisconsin. What is that all about? We will talk about that and much more during our All Things Political. And welcoming your phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Craig Gilbert is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief, and he also writes their Wisconsin Voter blog about politics and elections. Hello, Craig.
How are you doing?
I'm cold. I had to bring my coat into the studio, actually. It's warm now, but I got a big scarf. We're not used to, you're probably in D.C., but it's cold here today. You know?
Yeah, we've been spoiled in D.C. by a ridiculously warm winter with occasional, I think it's gotten down in the teens only twice, which was a shock after, you know, a day or two after it got up into the 60s. So, El Nino is doing its work here.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, at any rate, it's toasty now. Let's start with those numbers out of Iowa and New Hampshire before we talk about Johnson and Feingold and Trump in Wisconsin. It would appear to me that, Bernie Sanders, you know, I don't know if he stands a chance of being the nominee, and let me ask your thoughts on that. But he is inching up in the polls here. Are people liking Hillary less the more they see of her? Are they resonating with his message, or is this just a fluke?
I don't think it's a fluke, but I do think this is where the primary calendar really comes into play, because Iowa and New Hampshire are arguably Bernie Sanders' best two states for a long time on the primary calendar. Now, Wisconsin, if the race goes long enough, could turn out to be have some potential for Bernie Sanders, too. But what Iowa and New Hampshire have in common is that they're overwhelmingly white, and the Bernie Sanders constituency within the Democratic Party is overwhelmingly white. He's just not as well-known and not as popular among black and Latino voters. And so that's a huge mountain for him to climb when you consider the makeup of the Democratic vote, and then when you get to states where there's a significant non-white vote, which occurs throughout the South, and in other northern states, bigger states, more populous states, more urban states, it's a real problem for him, because then he has to win white voters overwhelmingly just to be competitive. So Hillary Clinton, when she ran against Barack Obama, she did not have that advantage because she was running against a candidate who was commanding overwhelming support from African-American voters. And now she's enjoying something approaching that, and it's a big hurdle for Bernie Sanders to overcome.
And in Iowa, it would appear, at least at this moment, it's within the margin of error, that Ted Cruz has a little bit of the big mo at this moment. Not that long ago, it was Trump, Trump, Trump. Now Cruz is leading Trump by 2.5 points.
Yeah, I mean, Ted Cruz is kind of, Iowa sets up really nicely for him because of his appeal to evangelical voters. I mean, the thing you always have to remember about Iowa is that because it's a caucus, a really tiny percentage of voters are participating, which is very much unlike New Hampshire, where everybody votes and it's kind of wide open and independents can pick which primary they want to vote in. In Iowa, it's just this sliver of the electorate, and these are people that are very committed and very ideological. Evangelicals make up a huge percentage of the Republican caucus vote. They're very conservative. So it's a great state for Ted Cruz. I mean, you know, these are some of the reasons why it was supposed to be a good state for Scott Walker, in addition to his coming from a neighboring state, but his potential appeal to evangelical voters and his conservatism. And that's why Scott Walker had an Iowa first strategy, and then and now he's gone, which is just one more piece of good news for Ted Cruz, because he doesn't have to compete with that, and it creates a more open path for him among the kinds of voters that dominate the Iowa caucuses. So he is very much the favorite in Iowa. I think it would be pretty harmful to him if he didn't win Iowa at this point. But, you know, he's certainly not the favorite in New Hampshire.
This is a comment, and I'm wondering what you think about it, from Josh Holmes, former chief of staff to Mitch McConnell, who told Politico this: at some point, we have to deal with the fact that there are at least two candidates who could utterly destroy the Republican bench for a generation if they become the nominee. And he's referring to Donald Trump, of course, and Ted Cruz.
Yeah, and that is a viewpoint within the Republican Party, the kind of professional class in the Republican Party. I think there's something to it. I mean, it might be overstated, but you know, certainly a lot of Republicans fear a Trump or Cruz nomination because they think that they would not only not be electable in a general election, but they would do a lot of harm to their congressional candidates. And you know, we're living in a world where elections tend to get nationalized, and so the presidential vote has a powerful impact down ballot on other races. If you just look at the Wisconsin, you know, landscape, and certainly I think it would be a concern for some of Ron Johnson's supporters, for example, if Donald Trump were the nominee, for the very same reason, that it makes it that much harder. It means you have to, if we assume, and let's just make this assumption, and you know, we can't prove it, but if we assume that Donald Trump would have a very hard time winning Wisconsin in a general election, then that means somebody like Ron Johnson has to outperform Donald Trump, and possibly by a significant amount, in order to win his Senate race, and that's not easy to do.
Mm-hmm. So, what is it that's fueling these numbers? What are, on the Republican side, what are people who are supportive of Trump and Cruz? Why are they interested in them? They're not really uplifting people. They tend to be kind of mean spirited many times. What's the attraction?
Well, I think there's a lot of different things going on. So, some of it is tone and rhetoric and attitude and style, and there is, you know, a lot of Republican voters are very angry. They're angry they're angry toward Obama, and they're angry toward their own party's congressional wing for not being able to stop Obama from doing things that he's done. And so that's part of it. And so and Cruz and Trump certainly speak to that in their style. They project that anger, and they kind of appeal to that anger. They're a little different in terms of their politics. I mean, Cruz is pretty, you know, he's very conservative ideologically on most issues, whereas Donald Trump is not a consistent conservative. I mean, Donald Trump is not offering the kind of traditional Republican economic conservatism that we've gotten used to seeing, which places a lot of emphasis on tax cuts for business, tax cuts across the board, including for very wealthy people, and entitlement cuts. Now he doesn't talk about that stuff. He's you know, one of the observations that's been made about the Donald Trump appeal within the Republican Party is that it follows kind of a class pattern, that he's appealing more and he's doing better with non-college voters, with lower income Republicans than the kind of business class of the Republican Party. And, you know, it's possible that this is a constituency within the Republican Party that the Republican leadership, you know, hasn't been catering to in terms of its economic agenda, whereas it, you know, it arguably has been catering to some degree in terms of its cultural and social agenda. So that's, you know, immigration figures into this clearly with both candidates. And so I think some of it is personality and tonal, some of it is just cultural, and it makes for an interesting kind of dilemma and debate within the Republican Party when it comes to the kinds of policies they want to lead with. There's some real competition going on right now about what the actual Republican policy agenda is going to be. It's not at all clear, particularly if we end up with a Trump nomination.
Right. Well, let's look at the Republican Party over the long haul. I've heard several people say, Craig, that, people know that the demographics in this country are changing. It's becoming more minority, and that is only going to continue as the years go on here in this century. And the Republicans, as everybody recalls, after the last presidential election, were doing some self-examination and saying we have to reach out to more minority voters. This is a losing strategy for us. And some people have said that they can't even think about winning the presidency on the basis of their opposition to immigration, that it's just not going to happen. They're going to lose the presidency for the foreseeable future. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think there is some truth to that, but, you know, it's sort of like a lot of predictions. It's easy to sort of say, to make the statement, but the timing is another question. And so, you know, when you talk about Republicans, about presidential elections becoming unwinnable for Republicans based on these kinds of current demographic patterns, the question is, at what point does that happen? And so that's one caveat. I don't think we can say that a presidential election is unwinnable for Republicans at this moment in time, but it may be that if nothing changes in these patterns, it will become unwinnable for Republicans, you know, at some point in the near future. But we just don't know exactly, you know, when that happens, because it depends on who votes and turnout. And it also, obviously, again, the big caveat is if nothing changes in these patterns. I mean, if you just look at, you know, if you sort of do the math for this election and, you know, one scenario for Republicans being able to win the White House is, well, Obama's no longer on the ballot, so maybe the African-American turnout is not quite as large as
yes.
It was for Obama. That takes something away from the Democratic vote. Maybe you can do even more to maximize the turnout of kind of white working-class voters, and maybe you can win them by an even bigger margin. If you make a lot of those kinds of adjustments, I mean, you can certainly come up with a scenario where Republicans win the presidential election this time around, but it is true that the math gets harder and harder based on demographic patterns if these other patterns don't change. In other words, if Republicans don't start doing better with black and Latino voters, yes, they're going to have it's going to get harder and harder for them to win presidential elections. Now, I think we've talked about this before, the same math doesn't necessarily apply to other kinds of elections. It doesn't necessarily apply to midterm elections where most governors get elected, and it doesn't necessarily apply to House elections where the makeup of these districts favors Republicans, and they can kind of weather the demographic storm for a longer period of time and hold on to their advantage in the House. But, you know, like all things in politics, nothing stays the same. Parties do adjust when they're failing, and the question is, you know, kind of when that happens.
Mm-hmm. You wrote a piece recently, and this is interesting, that Wisconsin is not warming to Donald Trump. Wisconsin may be as resistant as any place in America, you say, to the lure of Trump mania. Why?
Well, I'm not entirely sure. I just was tossing out theories in that piece. I mean, it kind of fascinated me that that's what the evidence in the polling seems to say, and I think the evidence very much says that. I mean, in fact, it's not just the Marquette polling. I mean, a few days after that piece ran, I believe it was the New York Times ran a map of the country where one of the kind of political analytics firms had shared this massive database they had, polling database, down to the congressional district. and they basically modeled how Trump's level of support among Republicans by congressional district across the country, and they mapped it. And you can see from the map that Wisconsin, that Trump was doing worse in Wisconsin than most other places. And so clearly there is a geographic pattern going on here. And, you know, it may be partly cultural in the sense that, you know, maybe Trump's very brash style and persona don't go over as well in mm-hmm. the Midwest. Now, he's doing better in Iowa than he is in Wisconsin, but he's not doing great in Iowa. So there could be something to that, to the, you know, that kind of upper Midwestern kind of cultural factor in terms of Trump's style and personality. But there are other things could be going on. I mean, it could just be, you know, there could be, you know, the fact that we had a candidate, Scott Walker, who was in the race, and at a time when Trump was expanding his appeal, Governor Walker remained a dominant Republican figure in Wisconsin and even clashed with Donald Trump to some degree. And even when he got out of the race, kind of made an appeal to Republicans to coalesce against Donald Trump. I mean, that could play into this a little bit. There could be other factors having to do with polling. And, you know, this is a state where there's a lot of political awareness, and Trump seems to do better among, and when you poll casual voters who don't know a lot, then, you know, a lot of people will say Trump because they've heard of him and they haven't heard of the other candidate. Mm. So there's a lot of little things. I'm not sure I know the answer to that, mm. but there does seem to be a regional pattern in Trump's appeal, as well as a kind of a demographic pattern, like we talked about before, where he does clearly better with working class Republicans than with more educated, upper-income Republicans.
We're going to go to phone calls, Craig, and we'll do that in just a moment. We have yet to talk about the politics of guns in Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race, which Craig wrote about very recently, in which he talks. He does a really interesting breakdown of gun ownership in the state of Wisconsin and looks at eastern Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin, the Green Bay area, rural Wisconsin, and who owns guns. Is it an equal number of Republicans and Democrats? And do positions on guns make a difference to Republican voters and to Democratic voters? What do Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold, what are their positions on guns? And what have they had to say about the president's executive action on guns last week? We're welcoming phone calls. We have a couple lines open. If you'd like to call now, that would be excellent. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is All Things Political. Our guest is Craig Gilbert. He joins us pretty often here on the Ideas Network. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and writes the Wisconsin Voter blog about politics and elections. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, All Things Political. Here we go. Not too long now until the Iowa caucuses. We're talking about both presidential sides, the Republicans and the Democrats, and looking where they stand now in Iowa and New Hampshire, and talking, we will in a moment, about the president's press conference yesterday announcing executive actions on what he hopes would reduce gun violence in this country, fixing this so-called gun show loophole. We will talk about that with Craig momentarily, and he wrote about how guns figure into the Senate race here in the state of Wisconsin. 800-486-8655, our number. Lynn in Eau Claire is our first caller. Craig, hi, Lynn.
Hi, Kathleen. Good afternoon, Craig. I find politics fascinating, and I also wonder what motivates people. So, in that, being that the caucuses in Iowa, there's a lot of evangelicals, why does it seem that candidates with a problem with truthiness seem to grasp the attention and adoration of that sector of our you know, body politic?
And you're concerned about Trump and Cruz, I'm assuming, or who are you talking about?
Yes, I am. Yeah, because they, you know, there's just that they're seeing there's a lot of question, you know, as far as truthiness and you know, building, you know, a wall that's just, you know, ridiculous, can't happen. And is it fear? What motivates, you know, I'm not an evangelical, I'm not a Christian, and what motivates people?
Craig.
Well, it's kind of an open-ended question. I do think that you know, when you're talking about very committed voters who are, you know, whether they're partisan or ideological or have a very strong belief system, and those are the voters that are going to dominate in a caucus system in either party, that those voters are the ones that are the most entrenched in their politics and their worldview. And so, you know, that's just the reality of our politics. And that those voters are, you know, pretty much, those are hardcore voters and hardline voters, and hardcore and hardline candidates are going to appeal to those voters. You're going to find something a little different going on, again, in a state where there's a bigger turnout. But, you know, it's all in the eye of the beholder. I mean, what one voter thinks is you know, faith-based reality is something else to another voter.
Thank you, Lynn, for your call. Sarah in Lake Zurich. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, hi. You know, speaking of Ted Cruz, there's this editorial that I read in the Chicago Tribune from December, which is written by Stephen Chapman, who's like, I think he's been a real conservative commentator, but he's got this editorial called Ted Cruz's Festival of Fraud, Nonstop Mendacity on Global Warming, and it is just hammering him. And I am really afraid of Ted Cruz because he seems electable to me. And I just want to read this one sentence. It says, Ted Cruz's patented formula is a mix of repellent ingredients, misrepresentation of facts, baseless smears, exaggerated sincerity, and pretended solidarity with the average person. And he just says that, like, he just lies, like, nonstop. And so that's why Ted Cruz terrifies me. And I have to say that I like Bernie Sanders, but very, very skeptical that he could get elected. And I really don't think Hillary could get elected either, although who knows. But
Somebody's got to get elected.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's how these nominees, you know, somebody's got to get nominated. You can always come up with a reason why candidate A or candidate B or candidate C can't win or can't get elected. But in the end, somebody's got to get elected. So somebody's going to be left standing on the Democratic side, and somebody's going to be left standing on the Republican side, and one of those two flawed candidates is going to be our next president. I do think it's a real question of electability is a real question in the case of Ted Cruz, and it's probably a question in the case of Bernie Sanders as well. But, I mean, you do have, you know, these are candidates who are at one end of the spectrum within their party in the United States Senate on most issues. And so you're talking about nominating for the whole country someone who's at one end, ideological end of your own party. And that raises electability questions. I mean, you know, the parties are polarized, so we're going to get very different candidates no matter who they nominate. And basically, almost by definition, you know, whoever the Democrats nominate is probably going to be to the left of the country as a whole, and whoever the Republicans nominate is going to be to the right. But the question is how far? And you do have a spectrum within the Republican field. You have candidates that are, you know, temperamentally or ideologically closer to the center, and ones that are temperamentally or ideologically closer to the flank. And Ted Cruz is both those things. So, yeah, there's a real electability question. That's why, you know, there are Republicans, you know, establishment Republicans, professional Republicans, whatever you want to call them, Republican strategists, who worry about a Ted Cruz nomination just as they worry about a Donald Trump nomination. They're not the same politician, and they have, you know, their nomination would have different implications for the party. But I think they both, there are big electability questions about both of them.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about guns for a moment, because we haven't had a chance on this show to talk about the president's executive action last week. And you wrote a really interesting piece on the Senate race here in the state of Wisconsin, Feingold Johnson race, saying that with Obama putting guns on the election agenda, the issue could animate this year's U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin. How so? And tell us more about what the positions are, Johnson and Feingold's positions.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think guns is going to be the dominant issue in their race, but I do think it presents an interesting, dynamic politically, and I think some nuances for a lot of reasons. I mean, one of them is that if you look at, Wisconsin is a state where there's a lot of gun owners. I mean, more than half of the voters, according to the exit poll, in the last presidential election, we're gun owners, but they're not monolithic. I mean, we tend to think of, all the gun owners are Republicans and the non-gun owners are Democrats, and the Republicans are all, pro-gun and anti-gun control, and the Democrats are all the other way. I mean, nothing is as clear-cut as that. And in some ways, it's not as polarizing and divisive an issue as we sometimes think it is. And if you look at who owns guns? I mean, there are Republicans, certainly are more likely to have a gun at home than Democrats. But, there are parts of the state where almost as many Democrats live in gun households as Republicans. And there are parts of the state where, in northern and western Wisconsin, where, Democrats are more likely to have a gun at home than a Republican in eastern Wisconsin. So those are just some nuances to keep in mind. And then when you look at how some of the issues poll, background checks, there's broad support in both parties for universal background checks. Other issues like an assault weapons ban is much more polarizing along party lines. And the other interesting nuance I would add about guns and attitudes is that, if you take Democrats, for example, if you're a Democrat who's a gun owner, you're really no more or less likely to approve of President Obama than a Democrat who does own a gun. And even if you're an independent who's a gun owner, I mean, independents and gun households aren't any more or less pro or anti-Obama than independents in households without guns. So it's really more about your partisanship than about whether you own a gun or not. And then when you look at the differences between these two candidates, there's some nuance, too, mostly because Russ Feingold, who's perceived as a pretty liberal Democrat, has always been, if you want to use a simplistic term, liberal, whatever you want to call it, he's been kind of a more pro-gun rights than the average Democrat, certainly the average liberal Democrat. And he's taken votes when he was in the Senate. He originally voted for the assault weapon ban, then he voted against it and now opposes it. He's taken gun votes that were perceived as pro-gun. He's taken gun votes that were perceived as pro-gun control. He's, in favor of background checks, in favor of a waiting period, but on other issues, has been voting more with Republicans. So it's a mixed bag in Feingold's case. And so that could blur the lines a little bit to whatever extent there is a gun debate in the Senate race.
What about the amount of money the NRA puts into ads, et cetera? You write about them backing Johnson in 2010. They are very politically active and, as you say, a powerful force in Wisconsin as well as in the country.
Yeah, and I do think, it doesn't mean they can sway an election. I mean, they do have power. And they certainly have influence over the legislative process. They have more power, certainly, within the Republican Party than within the Democratic Party. I don't think they have the kind of power to sort of tip the balance in anything but a very close, very, very close Senate race. But their impact could be felt. And they haven't gotten involved in every Feingold race, but they did get involved in the last one. I don't think that was the reason Feingold lost. He lost for much bigger reasons. But they will probably play in this race, I would think. They don't like Russ Feingold, not just for some of his gun votes, but also, Russ Feingold is like he's the guy that's identified with campaign finance regulation, and the NRA is absolutely on the other side of that issue.
Mm-hmm.
So there are other reasons beyond gun policy that they would oppose a Russ Feingold. But again, the one of the nuances on the in the gun debate, you know, there, it's not just, you know, it's not just gun owners that are voting. It's also people that don't own guns and non-gun households. If you look at Obama in 2012, I mean, he didn't lose gun households by that much. He only lost them by 7 points. But he won households that where there is no gun, if you want to call it that, mm-hmm. by like 30 points. So, you know, there's a push on both sides of the issue. And it's particularly when you talk about an issue like background checks, it's pretty popular across the board. Even among Republican voters. So it can cut both ways.
Well, let's listen to what the president said. We haven't had a chance to respond to this. How much front and center does it put this issue with the president making these announcements about executive action last week? And then it will move us into a conversation of the legacy of the president and who runs on that. Does it behoove Hillary Clinton to run on I'm the heir to an Obama presidency and I'm happy, or does she want to carve out new territory for herself? But let's talk a little bit more about this. This is the president last week on his announcement that he was taking executive action, which he said would reduce, he hoped to reduce gun violence, and this is what he had to say.
So, all of us need to demand a Congress brave enough to stand up to the gun lobby's lies. All of us need to stand up and protect its citizens. All of us need to demand governors and legislators and businesses do their part to make our communities safer. We need the wide majority of responsible gun owners who grieve with us every time this happens and feel like your views are not being properly represented to join with us to demand something better.
So how does that issue play into the general election? And why is it, Craig, that after announcement like this of executive action, people go and buy more guns?
Well, there is clearly, there are people who are afraid for their gun rights. And, it seems to me, as just an observer of our political process, the chances of anybody's guns being taken away on some, you know, broad level are pretty remote, given we have a gun culture in our country, and it's pretty established, and it's pretty broad. But there is, obviously among some gun owners, and there is, you know, the gun owning population, as we talked about, is not monolithic. I mean, there are a lot of people that have one gun or two guns or have a shotgun for hunting, and then there are some people that have lots of guns, and some of those people that have lots of guns are you might call, would refer to themselves maybe as gun nuts or gun, people that are really into guns, and some of them just are, you know, just like to go out and target shoot or hunt or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to overgeneralize about all this and about gun owners, which I don't think you should do. The pattern has been that when, you know, the debate has been stoked up and when there's been sort of more discussion and debate about gun legislation, it's been like ignited gun sales. And so the interesting thing about the response, or one of the interesting things about the response to the president's executive actions, was that, you know, one response was it doesn't really amount to much. This is kind of penny ante stuff.
Right.
And the other response was that this is a gross overreach and a threat mm-hmm. to gun rights. I think these were fairly limited compared to a lot of things that have been discussed in the past. I think they were fairly limited proposals. And certainly if you look over time, the kinds of things that are kind of the get mainstream political discussion when it comes to gun legislation have become more modest over time. I mean, you know, no, we're not debating an assault weapon ban anymore, really. And that was actually legislated by the Congress in the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
there was a time, if you go back before the 1990s, when, you know, there were debates about, you know, gun registration and gun licensing and limits, and much broader limits on guns than we're discussing today. So the politics is there and the feelings are really intense, but what's actually being discussed, I think, has probably become more modest over time.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Adele in Sturgeon Bay next. Hi, Adele.
Hi, good afternoon. I'd like to redirect the conversation back to the Iowa caucuses for a minute.
Sure.
And express ignorance as to exactly what happens at a caucus. And also some other broader questions like, is there one per precinct for each party? Or can anybody host a precinct? And how do you get invited to one? Some general questions of that ilk.
So these are events that are really put on by the parties in both states, and the two parties don't do them exactly the same way, and that's one thing to remember. But they are, you know, the reason the turnout is smaller is because it requires more effort than just going into a voting booth and casting a vote. It requires going to a meeting place and kind of interacting with other people and spending a little bit of time. And they're different for both parties, but in some cases, what happens is, and these are, they're all over the state, and they could be, you know, they could be at a home, they could be at a meeting place, depending on which party you're talking about, it can be kind of a multi-stage process where everybody expresses their preference, and then the candidates who don't reach a certain threshold are cast aside, and then those people have to decide who their second choice is, and it takes a while. So that's, you know, that's the dynamic, and it's it requires real commitment and real interest and real motivation to go out and participate in this. It's not like you have 15 hours. You can pick any moment in a 15-hour day to go and spend, you know, 5 minutes or 10 minutes casting a vote and then go home. The window is much smaller, but the amount of time you spend is much bigger. So that's what limits, and the justification for a caucus, if there is one, is that, you know, it places some, it's a test of, you know, a candidate's ability to organize, mobilize, and motivate voters as opposed to just pure, you know, preferences in the electorate.
They're actually kind of fun. We went to one in 2008, and it was really interesting to watch the whole process in action. I kind of liked it, Craig.
Well, you know, it's just one contest. I mean, you
right.
know, it is, it's a big deal because it's the first one, but, you know, more often than not, the winner of the Iowa caucuses did not necessarily go on to become president or win the nomination of their party. It's followed up in 8 days by New Hampshire, and because New Hampshire's it's got one similarity with Iowa, which is it's overwhelmingly white, but it's a very different state politically in a lot of ways, and even the makeup, for example, of New Hampshire Republicans is quite different than Iowa. The Iowa Republican Caucus, I mean, it's much more secular. It's a different political dynamic, and different candidates tend to do well there. And it's the biggest turnout primary in the country every time by the percentage of voters that actually participate, which is the antithesis of the caucus, and so. It's a very different test, and so you got candidates that have kind of an Iowa-first strategy and candidates that have a New Hampshire-first strategy, and so Iowa gets overtaken. I mean, it helps winnow the field, for sure, but then
sure.
it gets overtaken by a very different state, and then you go on to different parts of the country, and then you start going to other states, and Iowa may be forgotten.
Yeah. Thanks, Adele, very much for your call. George in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, regarding the Iowa caucus also and other primaries and caucuses, just curious, Mr. Gilbert, I admire the work that you do in D.C. I hope Gannett will keep you there for as long as you want to before you retire. But,
thank you.
I think that the reason that I'm supporting Sanders, aside from agreeing with what he has to say more than with Clinton, is I do think that for most Democrats, they're really looking for something that would be a much more progressive change. I fear that if Hillary is elected, it's pretty much going to be stalemate as usual. I don't foresee the Republican, perhaps the Senate would change over to Democrat, but the House won't. However, if Sanders gets elected, the only way he's going to get elected is if perhaps tens of millions more Americans come out to vote for him who ordinarily wouldn't vote. And if that happens, you could see a sizable change in Congress itself.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that's theoretically possible. It just seems unlikely that voting is habitual, and we don't often see just abrupt, dramatic changes in voting habits. When Barack Obama ran for president, he did draw some people, some voters that hadn't voted before, no doubt. But it's just not something that happens all the time, and it's not something you can count on as your recipe for victory, is that suddenly you're going to change the electorate, because it's not easy to do. And so that's, there are always debate. We have these running debates every cycle of within both parties about how to win an election, and whether it involves, just motivating your base more and getting, more of those people to turn out, so they're not, your base isn't depressed and demoralized, or whether it's more about appealing to voters in the middle and winning swing voters. Basically, these are arguments of convenience. They end up being arguments of convenience. So if you're a ideological candidate, you're going to argue it's about motivating the base. And if you're a more pragmatic candidate, you're going to argue it's more about winning over swing voters. It's obviously about both in the end. But it's just, it's just a tough strategy to count on, that you're going to suddenly change the nature and the makeup of the electorate. It doesn't happen that often.
Mm-hmm. And why is it, do you think, and George, I'm interested in your input on this as well, let's talk about minority voters. Why would they be much more likely to vote for Hillary Clinton than for Bernie Sanders, when Bernie's record on civil rights is a long one and a pretty stellar one?
Well, they don't know him.
Hmm.
He represents a very white state where he hasn't really had to develop relationships in that community. Certainly not nationally, and there's not much of a community in Vermont. Hillary Clinton has this history and some goodwill there. So that's a big part of it.
Mm-hmm. George, do you think he can win without attracting a number of minority voters?
You're talking about would he be able to beat Hillary in the primaries?
Yes.
I think that would be hard. I think he has to try to appeal to more primary voters. I think that's one of the big hurdles that he has to climb, because it's a substantial portion of folks that are going to be voting in the primaries. So I think he does have to work harder to appeal more to those voters and to show that the policies that he is advocating actually would help them more than what Hillary is.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, George, for your call. Let's go to Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Two things. A lot of talk is going on about how the so-called Republican establishment is so worried about a Cruz or a Trump nomination. And you notice they are not concerned about the politics, the positions of either those two men or others. They're just afraid of their not being elected by the majority of Americans, and therefore a loss to Republicans in the elections. They don't object to the vile policies that those men are spouting. And the other thing, the Republican establishment, such as it is, has not only condoned the demagoguery over the last three decades coming out of Rush Limbaugh and his clones on TV and radio and the internet. They have not only condoned it, but encouraged it in creating a mindset among people with their vile attacks on the president, their hatred, expressed hatred of authority, of government authority, and all of that, that is coming out of Republicanism in general. And now they're wringing their hands that the chickens are coming home to roost. They need to acknowledge their complicity in creating this polarized, dysfunctional, political politics that are now going on in our country.
Thank you, Kurt. Craig.
You know, one thing I would say is that the caller said in the early part of his remarks that these members of the Republican establishment have no problem with their policies, just their fear about electability. They do. There are some concerns about some of the policies, you know, that some of them, I mean, there are members of the Republican establishment that object to some of Donald Trump's policies because they don't think they're conservative enough. I mean, you heard one of the Koch brothers come out and express this concern the other day. And there are some that are concerned about some of their policies because they think they're too conservative, for example, on immigration. So there is a, you know, there are, depending on who you're talking to in the Republican establishment, there are not only electability concerns, but there are also some concerns about the tone of their campaigns, the kind of message they're sending, and also about some of the policies that they're advocating. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ted Cruz, you know, was, like I said, he was not in the middle of the Republican caucus in the United States Senate. So he took a lot of positions that were antithetical, whether they were tactical or not, that were not kind of mainstream Republican positions, that were either a little more, he went, you know, a little further to the right than his Republican colleagues, or just in tactical terms, way beyond what they were willing to do. And Donald, in the case of Donald Trump, it's a little different because Donald Trump, on one set of issues, is very conservative, but on a different set of issues, like some of the economic and fiscal issues, is not pushing the kind of traditional conservative Republican fiscal and economic agenda.
Go back in history, if you can find something that is at all similar, Craig, to the Donald Trump candidacy or Ted Cruz. I've heard the Cruz candidacy mentioned in some ways as historical reference being Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, yeah. I think that there is something to that. I think, you know, flawed parallel with Donald Trump is Pat Buchanan, in the sense that, you know, kind of similar, some similar issues. I mean, it was that, it was sort of that appeal to kind of, there was a little bit of a blue-collar or white working class appeal, and there was also on issues like immigration. And so there were some, you know, in terms of substantively, there were some parallels, I think, with Buchanan to Trump, whereas with Cruz, I think Goldwater might be a better parallel.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Kurt, for your call. Roger in Park Falls. We have time for another call, too, after Roger. 800-486-8655 is our number. Hi, Roger.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a couple of comments. One is, for context, both comments are, that households that own guns is 31% of the population. So that should be a context. Number two is that refer to Donald Trump as he is. He's a demagogue. A definition of demagogue is a leader who makes use of popular prejudices and false claims and promises in order to gain power. I think a good example is put up the Mexican wall and have Mexicans pay for it. I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Roger.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people have a similar reaction to Donald Trump. So it would be such an extraordinary thing if he ended up being the nominee.
Yes, it would.
It could really, you know, rip the Republican Party apart in some ways. On the guns, the numbers I see are higher. I mean, different people come up with different numbers. I mean, the numbers I've seen in terms of the percentage of households that have guns at home range from the mid-30s to the mid-40s. But then when you talk about voters, they go up, because those people are more likely to vote. Mm. So that's why you have, in a state like Wisconsin, I don't know what the national figure was, but again, in a state like Wisconsin, it was a presidential year, so it wasn't an electorate just dominated by conservative voters, and 55% of the people in the exit poll said that they had a gun in their household. So it is a substantial population, but I don't think it's a monolithic population that votes as a block.
1 minute left. Tim in Johnson Creek. Hi.
Hey, how are you guys? A long-time listener to the show. Excited to get the call in.
Thanks, Tim.
My question was, I'm kind of all across the board on my beliefs. I'm a hunter and a gun owner, but I don't really see an issue with the with the latest executive action. And from what I've heard from a lot of my friends as we've discussed it, everybody's already required these background checks. And if Obama really wanted to do something in regards to gun control, for the 2 years that the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate, when they basically could have passed anything that they wanted, why wasn't any action taken up then?
All right, thanks, Tim. About 30 seconds, Craig.
Well, there were, within the Democratic Party, you have differences on this, and certainly there have been Democrats from more conservative states or states with, higher rates of gun ownership that have voted against gun regulation, absolutely, in the Senate and the House, but particularly in the Senate.
Craig, thank you, as always, for being with us, for an enlightening
Nice to be with you anytime.
All right, thank you.
I'll look forward to I'm coming back to Wisconsin for the debate in February, so
okay.
I'll get a taste of winter.
Going to Iowa, I'm sure?
Going to Iowa, New Hampshire,
there
South Carolina.
You go. Yeah, it's going to be a year. Thanks. Craig Gilbert, our guest. Yeah, oh, that's right. The debate is coming up in Wisconsin. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour and to K.P. for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios as well. News coming up.